Hello and welcome to The Corporate Activist. I'm Siri Khalsa, and I'm delighted to have you join me today for another great conversation about how businesses can engage in social and political issues to lead positive change in the world. One of the industries I've been really interested in terms of its approach to corporate activism and social impact, is the video gaming industry, particularly because of its size and growth rate, its impact on the mental and physical health of young people, and its reputation for violence, racism, and misogyny. In 2024, global revenue of video games is estimated to be around $280 billion, with about 3.5 billion video game players worldwide. I was lucky to find a guest who is uniquely qualified to speak on these topics. Sophie Vo is a game executive with over 15 years of experience working at Gameloft, Woga, Rivio, Voodoo, and PlayStation, building studio and people's departments, guiding teams through change, launching games, and running live ops. Sophie is also the founder of Rise and Play, a network and knowledge-sharing platform for the conscious leaders of the gaming industry, who advocate for a human-centric approach to game development and teams. She works with companies to create the future of games while promoting sustainable working cultures. And Sophie has also just launched her own gaming studio called Kylan, which I look forward to hearing more about in our conversation today. Welcome, Sophie.
Hi, Siri. Nice to be the guest for once at the podcast.
Yes, I should mention that you are also a podcaster, so I want to hear more about that. But Sophie, I'd love to start just by getting to know you a little bit and learning about your background, your education, and how you got interested in gaming, as well as leadership and social change.
So maybe for my background, I can start with what I've done before. I've been working 16 years in the gaming industry. And actually, before I even got into games, I studied business. So I was not meant to even get into games. But I studied at an exciting time in games where not AAA games, but mobile games was emerging and premium games. So, you know, on those phones, like Nokia phones with a keyboard, developing, I think it was 32-bit games across all devices at Gameloft as a producer. And yeah, throughout my whole career, moving from different business model, premium games on mobile to free-to-play web-based games on mobile, and running games with live ops. I moved to Berlin, joined a company named Wooga, and also did some time in Finland, continuing my journey in games, working for the listeners maybe who know that franchise, Angry Birds, for a company making Angry Birds at Rovio, to the point that I built my own studio as well, so came back to Berlin to do it. So it was a whole journey on product management, leadership. When I built my studio, it was with Voodoo. And I took over another studio bought by PlayStation, Savage Games in Berlin. And throughout that whole journey, I built at the same time parallel Rise and Play, which was a platform that I wanted to, a space I wanted to build, focus on leadership in games, because it was not even a topic or focus of attention.
I'm curious to know, did you grow up like playing games? Was there a game that really caught your attention when you were little that made you want to work in gaming?
So for my background in games, actually, I've played games since I was a kid, and it was an activity we were doing a lot with my dad and my siblings. So we were playing, I think, on the first console, Atari, and then Mega Drive.
Right. Yes, Atari.
Yeah. But some games that really marked me, I think I can think of Final Fantasy VII, which is still a big franchise. There's a new game, the remake, a version on PlayStation. So it has always been a hobby for me and still is today, but just was not a path for career, because there was no career for people who didn't come from a creative path to work in games at the time.
Right. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And so, but you did find a way to work in gaming, and you've done that, it sounds like, all your career, which is really, really amazing. And then you also decided that there was a gap in the market, there was something missing, and you founded Rise and Play. So I'd love you to tell us, what is Rise and Play? What's its mission, and what do you do with it?
Yeah, so I started it 3 years ago. What started maybe, you can call it a COVID project, because I had a lot of time at home to reflect on even if I wanted to continue in games, to be honest, and what I wanted to do with my life, with my time. And I've been, when I started it, I've been over a decade in gaming already, and I get frustrated actually to see so little attention from top management of most companies I've been part of, or others that I heard from friends. Little attention on the human side of a business, because at the end of the day, people make games and great games, and there've been maybe an over focus on the business of games, the revenues that it can create, just optimizing more and more at the cost, you know, of people. And so I wanted to create my own platform just for communication, for content, to talk about leadership in games and how do we make the industry better, how can we be more conscious. So the whole Rise and Play is about conscious leadership and not just leadership. And what does that mean? It's about being more aware about your responsibility, what you're supposed to do, your blind spots, so how emotions play in your decision making, especially of important roles of responsibility, and at the end of the day, be more self-aware, conscious about the consequences of the decision, whether they are on the people or the business. So that's how it started. And like I said, it expanded to a podcast where, instead of sharing my own practices on how to build a sustainable studio, I invited other guests who have done the same at the company level or studio level to share their own learnings and experience.
And are those are studios all over the world who are working in gaming?
Yes.
Yeah, amazing. Well, we'll definitely put a link to your podcast and to Rise and Play in the show notes.
Thank you.
I'd love, you know, this is really an education for me, and I have a lot of curiosity about the gaming industry. I'm not a gamer, but I see the impact it has and, you know, just how many people are playing, how dedicated they are, how big the industry is and how much it's growing. And so maybe you can tell us a little bit about the history of the gaming industry's relationship with social impact or the idea of social responsibility. Like you're saying that you noticed just three or four years ago that there was a problem, but has there ever been more of a consciousness about social responsibility from gaming, or is it just something that's trying to emerge now?
Well, maybe let's go through the history of games, digital games quickly for the answer I'll give. So games, it was almost 40 years ago, was really a discipline of art. So very creative, it was very niche. So games made by gamers for gamers. It was not a mass market product. And it has evolved thanks to platforms, right? So one platform, for example, was a social media platform, Facebook, that opened the platform for games that you could play, like Farmville at the time. And then you had mobile devices that became a platform with capability to power games. So that became more of a mass market entertainment product, like you would watch movies or listen to music. And so as that has changed, it has also changed quite a lot the landscape of who makes the games. So not only gamers, but people who would come from other industries, consumer apps, for example, a business. You would have other fields like marketing, data science, because in mobile there's a lot of analytics. So it opened also the industry, the profession, to a lot of other fields and other people. And as we are serving now a global audience and not just gamers, there's, of course, more conversation because we have more diversity, I'd say. Not a lot of diversity, but more than before in gaming, to have conversation where, okay, how do we make this sustainable? How are we creating products? We talk more about products for games now that have a positive impact in the life of players/consumers. How do we ensure that we're not building products that just create addiction? And, you know, just for the interest of companies that want to make money, but at the cost, again, of individuals. So I wouldn't say that it's a global trend from all organization, but there's definitely more conversation of responsibility. And even these days, there's a lot of economic correction in terms of company after acquisition, where you see a lot of layoffs, and there are also a lot of conversation, a lot of pushback on how those layoffs are done. So I'd say there's more awareness of social responsibility, but it's not at the core of the businesses, because at the very core, a lot of companies are funded by sometimes venture capitalists, and the primary motivation of venture capitalists is to return the investment with a multiplier. So it's very geared toward growth, revenue, profitability.
You've mentioned a few shortcomings, but I suppose I've been seeing that there's both sort of some external things that need to get worked on in terms of the actual games themselves, like being very violent in some cases and misogynistic and even racist within the game itself. And then there's the more internal side, where we also see some of that behavior at the gaming companies, and that it's largely a male-dominated industry. So again, I'm asking because I don't know, but I wonder, what are some of the things that have stuck out, whether it's equality or inclusion, on both the actual game side as well as the gaming companies?
It's a complicated conversation around the few topics you mentioned about sexism, racism, because I think it's been amplified in games, but if you zoom out, you see some components of it everywhere, right? So of course in games it's much more visible because it's in the content as well. But I look at it more from a social point of view. When you look at, again, who is making the companies, especially on the leadership level, then it will have an impact on how the games are made and the representation and even the sense of awareness. So when it comes to, I'll take a concrete example because it's quite complicated to just, I won't be able to break it down.
We don't want to generalize too much too, I guess.
not at all, exactly, because I don't want to make it a simple conversation where it's much more complicated than that. But I can start with a concrete example. So let's say, for example, what we call sexism, which is quite different in games and in the companies. So I want to separate that. But what are the form of sexism in a game? Well, you can have in the content where maybe you still see characters, female characters, that are over-sexualized and objectified in the way they're represented. Well, why is that? There's a legacy, first of all. There's also maybe some games that have a majority of male players and they resonate with that, not women, but, you know, so there's, again, legacy, and there's also who are making the games. Maybe you have a majority of teams, you know, of developers that are also made of men and they don't see the problem of doing this, right? So there's that, but there's also a reality when you look at other games that are appealing to a broader audience and more women, you would see less of that actually, or not at all, because they are made with women as an audience in mind from the beginning. So it depends on what kind of games are we talking about. And there's another form of sexism in games. It's more on the community side among players. And that is also known, for example, if you are in a very mid-core game that has, again, a majority of men players, and you are the minority being part of a clan, a group, and you're identified as a woman, you can be very quickly the object of a lot of insults or harassment, moral harassment, or just exclusion. It's quite common. It's like toxic behavior in a very hardcore community. And I wouldn't tie it to gender, but it's a known behavior. Not to excuse it, but that's why it makes it very unsafe for women also to play multiplayer mid-core games. So there are some forms of that, and this again is a responsibility of a game company and the ones driving the communities. What are the code of conduct? You know, they like to set the boundaries in the system. And in a company level, it's different form of sexism, if we want to call it that way, that can happen where it's dynamic of power, right? So you have maybe people in a position of power, and because statistically you would see 80%, 90% of men in a leadership position, then you see often women being in a like lower hierarchy and in least position of power. And then because there's that dynamic of power, then you would have maybe some situation with a very gray area where some requests are asked, like to stay over a few extra hours or to come to some meetings in some places at some hours, or certain comments that maybe are uncomfortable for the receiving and like the woman. But because you want to, you care about your next promotion, keeping your job or whatever is at stake, then it happens in the workplace. So this is just an example, and there are many that are quite different, but I wouldn't put in the same category. But just to answer your question, that is not happening only in games.
Sure. Yeah, it's a reflection on our culture.
Yes, and also I look at it really from a social point of view. It's a dynamic of power, and it's majority versus minority groups and representation, and yeah, mostly dynamic of power.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. And so I'm sort of curious that the people that you're working with at Rise and Play, are they game like studio leaders who are thinking, you know, it's time for a change in our culture? Like what's driving them? Is there some pressure from players or society for a change to happen? What's driving the change?
So games is an industry of passion, right? So if we don't have a heart in what we, it's hard. It's really hard to work in games. So if we don't have a conviction on what we're doing, then why bother? So for the ones that are rallying around the movement with Rise and Play, they want to work in the industry with their terms, on their terms, with their values. And what does that mean? Around sustainability, mutual respect, inclusion, awareness. So because we are in a position of power, by a position of leadership, some of us are founders, some of us are influencers, some of them have a huge network, our voice has an influence, and it becomes almost a responsibility. Like, what kind of industry do we want to be part of? How can we shape the future? And we do have that power, so let's do something about it. And that's what comes in the conversation, where either we are gathering at networking events and having those hard conversation in front of an audience that are not necessarily founders, but maybe future founders, future leaders, to just be aware of that. Or when we do podcasts, to really create again the awareness in the industry, and it's paying off. So what started with a small movement, I started this alone, I had more and more collaborators, partners along the journey. And just to see that it's on par with how the world is evolving, at least from the West. So I want also to here give a nuance. We are in a luxury position and privileged position to even think about that, where when I spend time in Southeast Asia, in India, where of course there's that awareness, but there's so much more to solve already on a pure, I would say, basic level of health, you know, food, shelter, economic growth, that for us coming from the West, this is the main thing we can worry about in the future. How do we create it more sustainably? But it's, again, we are in a bubble and with a certain lens to worry about those things, where in other places, you know, it's other challenges that are happening.
What are companies actually doing to bring about some of this? Like, are they putting in some internal policies around, you know, standards of behavior? And are they trying to change their products at all to make them less violent or to make them, you know, less misogynistic?
It really depends, again, on who's leading the company. So there are some of those motivations. They are from the beginning, because that's the way the company wants to exist, right? So a company, for example, that is behind Monument Valley, Us2 Games, they have a B Corp certification, for example. So this is the kind of commitment, how far you can go when you really want to live according to your values. And it's through the teams, through how they hire, through the games they make. So it's through all DNA of the company. And they are not incentivized monetarily to do it. It's just a way to exist, right? And you have others that still have violence in the games, but it's a moral judgment, you know? It's they are still making a lot of revenues. They are not making the world worse. I mean, myself, I like games, and I have games where there's fighting, and I don't feel negative about it, right? So again, it's to take with a grain of salt, where who's being hurt in the process? And what is it to be really fixed. And it's not because the game has some fighting mechanics or competitive mechanics that is wrong. It's more how it's done, in which condition, how it's done, how what is the awareness, responsibility towards the community and the impact, and how is the community acting around the game, and what is the company doing so it acts well, right? So I think it's more in those details that it matters rather than just the game.
And what about the players? Because the whole esports is growing like crazy. And again, it's something I'm very new to, but I've just seen that it's a huge industry, and there's players who are, you know, sort of celebrities in their own right. And it does seem like some of the players are taking on the responsibility of promoting better values in gaming. Have you seen that in any particular players, or do you see that as a trend?
So I'm not very involved in esports, so I wouldn't have anyone to mention on top of my head. But all I can say is, like in esports, and you see this with influencers, it's a newer, younger generation. And again, coming from a lens from the West, topics around inclusion, equality, awareness, it's more present for a newer generation, and that's why it's part, I would say, of a persona and the DNA of some of those personalities, as they are influencers, right? And they talk about things that are relevant for the community of other players who are probably the same age. So it's not a surprise that it's going that way. It's just there's a whole generation of, I would say, boomers generation that are keeping the legacy of how companies were formed, how products were formed. We're very focused on growth and the economics. And it's more from the millennials to the Gen Z that we have a bit more of this consideration. So there's also a generational focus that is different. So.
Yeah, and I guess there's been, from what I understand, a lot of, or there tends to be, sort of consolidation in the gaming industry, so that you have little studios that kind of pop up, but they, if they're successful, can get very quickly bought out by big, big media companies. And I imagine those big media companies, as you say, are run by a certain generation, and their values are not necessarily what's even, you know, the younger people who are making the games and playing the games don't share those same values. So I'm really excited to know that you're now building a new gaming studio called Kylan. And I'd love it if you could tell us about that and how you're planning to embed your social values into that company.
It's not even like an exercise for me that, okay, I make a plan and I apply my social values, because one thing I understood digging more into the work of leadership, you are your values, right? So by you building a company with what you believe, it will translate consciously or subconsciously in your company. So for me, what is very important is more to be aware of why I'm building a company, what do I want to create, who do I want to work with, and what are my values in life? Because with that awareness, I'm applying this in every micro decision I do every day. So that's why I believe in less over time in writing the values, like we see a lot on website and on the wall, because at the end of the day, they are words, but the real values is your daily behavior with others, how you interact, how you deal with yourself, and how you deal with others. So as long as for me, those are in check with what, you know, is it matters to me, what I call integrity, then, you know, we are all right as a company, because it's translated from what I believe. And a lot of those values are around connection. So everything I've done the past 20 years of my life or career, I've been around building connection among people, meaningful connection. And it can be seen in all the work I've been doing. But I've also very motivated by growth. So I love to learn. I love to learn new fields. I love to learn new things from people, from new challenges. So building a company is a whole learning curve itself. And that's also part of the DNA of a company. We are going to tackle not an easy challenge, but for people who love to experiment, to figure out something very complex, they will love the journey. And so those, I would say, the two elements of the values. And, you know, at the end of the day, how we treat each other, I have for myself a motto, which is make your decision always out of love rather than fear or hate. And so that's what's driving any of my decision. And so as long as I respect, you know, that principle, then I make the right decision for the company, even when it will be hard decision sometime, reducing the team, closing a project. It will be made out of love, but that doesn't mean that you don't make hard decision. And I think that's the tricky part for most founders and entrepreneurs, to mix kindness with still being responsible and making the hard decision.
Yeah, it's balancing. And I think that's a lot of our conversations on this podcast, is how do you balance your values with running a profitable business? Because in the end, if the business doesn't work, you know, your values are kind of irrelevant. So it is finding a way to make those things balance and make them both work. So I'm curious, have you developed any games yet? What kind of games are you going to be working on? Do you know?
Yeah, so that would be more of a question for my co-founder, who's leading the creative part. So all I can say right now is in action adventure category. It will be for a change, because I come from mobile over platform, because on mobile is very difficult at the moment, and with some multiplayer components. So it's more in the alley of my co-founder, who has done that kind of games, and it's the kind of games I like to play. So I'm excited to develop games that I also play myself, but that's not my main motivation. I also love a lot casual mobile games, as I've worked on in the past.
And do you think, for someone like me, maybe who hasn't played games, what do you think are the positive benefits of playing games?
You know, it's the activity of playing, and everyone plays. Everyone likes to play. It's a very fundamental human behavior and motivation. And games is just a form of play. So what are the values here? Why do we play? First of all, when we play, we reconnect to our inner child. So we reconnect to the part of us that is not thinking, it's not in the brain, in the mind, and worrying about what will other think of me or what is happening, what should I do? You are in the flow state, right? So you are back to a very, I would say, child state that is very pure, very imaginative and creative. And I think that's the beauty of, for me, playing games, to be in that state and in that experience, reconnecting with that part of the self. And then what has developed over the past years, you see this more on mobile, but also a lot of indie game development. There's a strong part of narratives in the games. And when you follow the story, it's the same like watching a movie. You consume a media content, and then some of the stories, you relate to them. So it makes you feel something, you know, emotions. Some story, they make you reflect on something. It could be really sad, it could be really deep, could be really heavy. So it makes you reflect in real life about important topic. So it has also an impact on your real life. It can be positive. And other values could be very social. So you play with others. You can play with others on your couch, like local play, or you play online and you start to build connection in a way that you could not, like in the more physical world, because you build connection on a different level. That could be, how do you collaborate around, you know, a play, or how do you play against each other, although you don't know each other, anonymously. And this could also be a value in real life. So many ways of impacting your life. But you can, like, you know, game doesn't have a morality to me. It's more a tool. What you make out of it then can have a good or bad impact. And the examples I shared could also be bad, where you can decide to tell story, where I'm going to give a very silly example, where you see women completely disempowered, and in a world where, you know, women are small, you know, and this can create a certain belief in your mind if you start to consume that kind of content. Thankfully, we don't have so much of that. Or you can have social play that makes you hate others because it's such a negative experience that you start to believe that everyone that will interact with you wants to harm you, you know. So again, back to responsibility, when you know that you can have impact in the life of consumers, players, to be very aware of what kind of experience you create.
I've come into contact a little bit with the VR space, and I'm curious if that's something you see growing, and if there's a sort of other element to that in terms of responsibility and in terms of that gaming companies have of actually then building whole worlds for people that again reflect a certain value structure. So any thoughts on VR?
So for me, VR, I'll answer about it from a more design and product point of view. I have not bought a VR headset. I think it's too expensive, and I am not sure of the space it takes at home, and I was right to not do it. So I rented actually a VR headset, and I played it for a month. And I loved it. It was an amazing immersive experience, something very unique I haven't experienced before this way. I think it's incredible what you can play. It opens a completely different dimension. And I think it can add, expand the experience of play and immersion. However, from a consumer point of view, I see a lot of barriers. First of all, one is the pricing. It's the logistical part. And, you know, it's when I think about the daily life and daily habits of people, it takes some effort to set up your VR thing, to have a mental energy to do it. It's also very exhausting for your eyes. It's not very social as an experience because what you see, others don't see it. So it is a lot of friction to become a mass market product. So I think it's great. I just still think today it's still a very niche product.
As you say, I think for people who are into gaming, it's something that it's a new way to experience some of their favorite games and probably will be pretty niche, especially because of the price point for a while. But I would imagine that technology is always developing, so who knows what we'll have next. Just to round this out, I'd love to get some of your expertise on, you know, some like best practices that you've seen some companies put into place, or any companies or games, gaming organizations or games themselves that you feel are really giving the right perspective on their values and right is such a subjective word, but are exhibiting the kind of values that we want, progressive values we'd like to see more of.
So like I said, I'm more skeptical over time about companies that claim values because again, they're really tested through the daily life and daily behavior. And I'd rather ask employees, how is it going for you in that company? So I would rather judge maybe answering the question more from how people have talked about companies that they really enjoy working at for the life there rather than the PR of it. And I can mention a few companies I've been part of that I have loved, and it was the right time, the right environment, very nurturing at the time of my career, like Wooga. And what I appreciated a lot, it's in Berlin, a casual mobile company. The founder was still there, Jens. And it was because Jens is a founder that has a very good heart and very caring, truly caring for people, that was translated in all the layers of the company, in who was working with him, the people he hired, the people who were at the head of different departments, in the system of a company. What does that mean? Like the incentives, the benefits, the way we would give feedback to each other, treat each other, the parties, you know, so it's translated in all the little bits of the company. And that's what I find really incredible when it's done well. It comes down again to the leadership and the founders, and the values are really transpiring really in the company itself. So good practices, I'd say leaders that are very conscious, that have awareness and a vision of what kind of company they want to build, and having the discipline to execute the company they want to build, because it's also a discipline. So you put the system in place. It could be code of conduct again, a handbook, reward, incentive based on the behavior you want to see in the company, punishment behavior. So for example, when you have behavior that cross boundaries, how is this how is this taken care of? If it's not taken care of, then it signals to people you can keep doing it. And that's how you get toxic culture. It's never starting with a bad intention. It's just, it slipped. And there was a lack of, action for bad behavior. So those are the best practices I've seen in that way. But I don't have concrete example really of companies. I have more examples of people that, you know, have done this, but it's it's a constant challenge overall. You have good moments and you have bad moments, especially in times of crisis these days where all those values are deeply, deeply tested.
And I have seen some companies that are using gaming to also further certain social impact missions. So around, they tie the use of the game to tree planting, or they are incorporating education to part of the game. So they are, you know, actually hopefully working on an internal level, but also building games that are, I think I saw something recently that was also around the oceans and plastics, and people are getting kind of creative because, as you said at the beginning, games are something, it's a way that we learn, it's a way that we are creative, it's a way that, you know, is very meaningful for people and fun, you know, and we're all looking for more fun in our lives. So it's really interesting to me to see how addressing some of these social issues that we know we need to work on, whether it's healthcare or environmental issues or education issues, that some companies are looking at how to address that through gamification. And, you know, that might actually help create, as you say, raise consciousness amongst players as a way that their game is not just, let's say, an escape to a world that is better than the one they're in, but actually helping to create a better world.
There are, again, many different forms of play, and there are many kind of games that you can create. So there's still a lot of room of different experiences, and games are very engaging. So that's one of a way to convey and engage people or consumers, you know, around certain ideas and values you want to distribute.
Yeah, no, it'll be really interesting. And I hope that this newer, you know, this up and coming generation of game developers and players will try to, you know, incorporate more of this into what they're doing. Sophie, you've been great with your time. I've got two wrap up questions, if you don't mind. So first, we talked a lot about companies, but I'd love it if you could give a shout out to a company or a brand that you feel is doing exceptional work in the activism space. And it doesn't have to be a gaming company. It could be any product that you like to use that you feel is engaged in their social responsibility.
Well, I'll stay in the games because they're the ones that are easier access to me in what they're doing. So one is Scott Coven, which is an organization that coach, mentors engineers on Unity, and I think soon Unreal, and focusing on priority communities from underrepresented, marginalized groups. And that's necessary because some of those groups don't have access to education or network sometimes. And with the same spirit, I have Wings, which is also a fund, also focused on founding teams that have at least one woman part of a founding team. So they are changing the game, and there are many other funds that are forming, I can't mention yet, that are really changing the game by placing different people and focusing on giving opportunities for different people that usually don't get those opportunities.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, great. Well, we'll put links to those in the show notes so people can have a look. And then final question, Sophie, what's something that's made you laugh recently?
My cat. She's around right now. I don't know where she's.
I think we might have heard her in the background at some point. What's she called? What's her name?
Leo, and she always has something silly to do. She's a bit like a clown at home, but she's my she's my joy. It was a COVID decision, but it's such a great decision. No, she has just her silly moment, and so she makes me laugh. And so at least I can say I laugh on a pretty healthy basis and daily basis thanks to her and also my partner, but more with my cat first.
Yeah, sort of a live action play there you got going on. That's great. Well, Sophie, thank you so much for joining, and we will certainly put links in the show note to Rise and Play, to Kylan, and to some of the other things that you've mentioned so people can follow up if they're interested. But it's really been an education for me because I've had a lot of interest in this industry and how it affects the players, but also, you know, society at large. And so I really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us. And for people who are interested, they should definitely check out your podcast and learn more about how leaders are changing and addressing some of the issues in the industry. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Siri. Have a great day.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Corporate Activist. Please stay tuned for new episodes and do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram at Corp Activist. The Corporate Activist is brought to you by Stance Advocacy Services and is produced by the good people at the Podcast Boutique. I'm your host, Siri Khalsa. Ciao for now.